Good morning. Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. The Theosophical movement has existed throughout time in different places and different nations, among different groups, wherever thought has struggled to be free. The great founders of the Theosophical movement have periodically sent forth agents, representatives of their great lodge of adepts to help assist the higher psychic, intellectual, and spiritual evolution of the human race. And we can trace their efforts throughout history. In 1909, the United Lodge of Theosophists was founded to help spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, whose writings represent the most complete public presentation of the ancient wisdom religion. More importantly, the mission of the ULT has been to give forth the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy in order that we might gain a truer realization and a profounder conviction that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. The key to the ULT, as well as the Theosophical movement down through the ages, has been the independent, individual devotion to the cause of Theosophy, which is the highest service of humanity. Without professing attachment to any Theosophical organization or particular devotion to any human being, in the sense following any kind of spiritual authority. The final authority rests with every human being, and we each have to test, check, and verify these ideas for themselves. So in keeping with this effort, which has gone on for throughout the ages, here in Philadelphia as part of that Theosophical movement, we have a few weekly activities. On Sunday mornings from 11 to 12, we have a formal presentation of the philosophy of Theosophy, particularly in its practical applications to the many aspects of our lives. This month of March, the general theme is the mystery of the mind, or the mysteries of mind. And this morning, our talk is on what frees or enslaves the mind. And next Sunday, the subject will be the nature and power of soul memory. The building opens on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. On Wednesday evenings, we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy written by William Q. Judge. We are now beginning the subject of Devakan, the second after-death state that the ego goes through after the death of the body. However, this coming Wednesday, March 18th, is a special meeting, which we'll mention in a moment, and so the actual next class on Devakan, subjective heaven world, will not be till March 25th. And our Wednesday evening meetings start at 7:30 and go through till 8:30 p.m. So next Wednesday, we have a special meeting, more of a devotional meeting called William Q. Judge Day, one of the founders of the modern Theosophical movement, Theosophical Society, in 1875. And the meeting will consist of a variety of devotional readings, a little bit of introduction to his life, biographical sketch, and a talk on William Q. Judge, philosopher, guide, and friend. We ask that you come a few minutes earlier to be in your seats, and so we can begin the meeting with a proper tone of devotion. Our library is open on Wednesday evenings from 5:15 to 7:15. The library contains straight-line theosophical literature, and as well a variety of books on philosophy, religion, science, art that supplement a broad theosophical education. It is a reference library, and you may find there whatever subject you would like to research or prepare for that evening's class by reading the part assigned in the reference. The librarian, a volunteer student, can help you in your research. But independent devotion, independent study is key. And so on the book table out here in the hall, we have a collection of straight-line theosophical literature, the original and reproductions of the original works by H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, so that each can independently study and verify for themselves the message put down and not have to be subject to the interpretations or corrections or editings or suggestions of others, students who came afterwards who may not have the same understanding. So it's a way to get to the teachings, the direct source for yourself, and make your own judgments. So on that book table, you also find devotional books and magazine articles, magazines. These items are available at cost of publication and shipping. There's no profit to be made. In fact, on our website here in Philadelphia and several of the websites of other ULTs around the world, you can access this literature free online. So it is available for all those who wish to study. The activities of this lodge go on through a voluntary basis of contributions in time, service, and money. No obligation is imposed or implied, yet all contributions are gratefully received and very much needed. So this morning then, we're going to have a forum, and the method of the forum is a short talk on the subject followed by a longer period of question and answers that allows us to examine the ideas presented in a little deeper and wider way than we might normally do. And so we mentioned at the beginning that the theosophical movement has existed wherever thought has struggled to be free, and since thought is the primary activity of mind, the subject this morning is very appropriate. What is it that exactly enslaves the mind, and what frees it? So we will have those ideas presented in a short talk, and then you're welcome to propose your questions and comments.
Good morning. What frees or enslaves the mind? It's been written and said quite often, the greatest enslaver of humanity is habit. Habit. This can be proved and verified by observing some of society's most pitiful members, addicts. All addictions start with a desire for pleasure or a desire to avoid pain. That is fundamental. And the fundamental word in that is desire. For through a repetitive desires, we build habits. We build prisons of habits. We trap that which is universal and make it local. We trap that which should be grand and make it petty. These are the true weights that hold us down. Desire is a two-edged sword. We know that you can't destroy desire. Desire first arose in it, we are told. We hear that quite often in these rooms. But we can elevate our desires. We can raise our desires up. We can make our petty desires transform into noble ideas, noble efforts. It's not a simple task, but it is definitely a doable task. We have witnesses, we have examples of those who have done this, so we know that it's doable. Selfish desires carry within them seeds of destruction, seeds of retardation, seeds that keep us from advancing, seeds that are adversarial to our natural instincts, to our natural way of being. What it is, they become not only unnatural, but they force us to bow down to that which we should be greater than. Now, as far as destroying, these are two quotes from the Bhagavad Gita, and they both tell us something profound, I think. He abandoneth the desire to see a reward for his actions, is free, contented, and upon nothing dependeth. Second, thus knowing what is greater than the discriminating principle, and strengthening the lower by the higher self, do thou of mighty arms slay this foe in which is formed from desire and is difficult to seize. In both of these, Arjuna is instructed that you can't destroy desire. You can transform it, but you cannot destroy it. And this is tells us something that we should look for. Since it is a universal principle, since it is something that we find in all of us, since it is something that is constant in nature, it is a tool. And as a tool, it is directed by how we use it. It becomes good or bad by our intentions, by our use of it, not by itself. So therefore, it has the ability to both free and enslave the mind. It is up to how we use it, whether it will do either, or which one it will do. Our endeavors are universal. When our endeavors are universal and dedicated to the abandonment of all in which we strive selflessly, regardless of the outcome, we are already successful. Regardless of what the outcome, if our purposes and our desires are pure, if we have divested ourselves of the reward, if we have divested ourselves of looking for some grant, benefit to ourselves, if we are doing this for a benefit for all of humanity, for all of manifestation, we've already won. There can be no loss in that because we become free. this is where we find our freedom at. This is where the mind really begins to soar higher. This is where we can shed the chains of these habits. This is where we look for that. And these don't need to be really large endeavors, you know, curing some worldwide epidemic or landing on the Mars is not required. Raising a child to be a kind and considerate neighbor, or as the old Greek Athenians vowed, to leave your family, neighborhood, community, and nation, and world better than how you found it. These tasks and vows, undertaken selflessly, will free the mind to the limitless horizons of true reality.
So this subject of what frees and enslaves the mind as presented can very often relate to desire as a universal principle. The ramifications of freedom and slavery are very wide as well. And so we have great opportunity here to discuss some of those ideas and how we can take our own responsibility in ensuring that we are not enslaved and can be free. Yes?
What creates the feelings? The mind, or the feelings have an entity of their own and they affect the mind?
What creates the feelings? The mind itself, as a thinking principle, as we know it, is naturally endowed with the capacity to feel. It can feel or touch the inspirations of its higher buddhi, spiritual nature, which are the nature of compassion, self-sacrifice, devotion, pure love, or it can feel the pull downward of our passions that are fueled by our sensations and some of our ideas. And so it can feel the influence of lust, of anger, of self-gratifying pleasure, of fear, hatred. It can feel all those things. It is not the source of that, but it is the witness, the observer. But our recognition that as thinkers we can be the observers allows us the ability to stand back and watch this play of feeling that dances before us, to discern, to discriminate which are higher and lower, and to choose with free will which ones we will entertain and which ones we will activate. If we do not have that knowledge, then more than likely we are going to be pulled down and subjugated to the lower because we do not know who and what we are as spiritual beings.
It seems many of our desires come from our own childhood. Maybe it was sibling rivalry, maybe a teacher who humiliated us, or a parent that didn't much like us. We carry these needs to overcome that, and we don't even realize we have it. So how do we use the mind to uncover these desires that keep pulling us and enslaving us?
Well, it seems many of our desires begin in childhood, but of course they become more sophisticated and expand. We have bigger toys as we get into adulthood. And our desires mature and expand as we do. But it's true, many of us, our desires are cultivated early in childhood, and it's because in those years, in our formative years, the principle that is most active in our nature is the desire, the feeling nature. Mind doesn't really make its connection and begin to discern and become active until perhaps between our 14th and 21st year. And so that's why in those turbulent teenagers' year, we see very often the questioning, the rebelling of authority, yet also the idealism and the search for something more than the standard way. The mind begins to question. And then as we get older, we get some more experience, we get some discrimination, we learn some lessons, and we go forth. So is there a way we can speed up the process a little bit? Do we have to go through all those years of suffering and trial and maybe or maybe not learn our lessons? Is there a way in which the mind can learn to be in charge? So in the Bhagavad Gita, for example, the example is made between, analogy is made between the horse and the rider, or the rider and who is the charioteer. And in this case, the rider is the mind. And the horses are the desires that pull the chariot forward. But the rider has to decide how to use the reins, in which direction to direct where that cart will go. So it does mean that we have to begin by realizing that we are always acting and we are always choosing, making choices. We may not be consciously aware of it, but we are always making choices as to which desires we will follow. So see, the first step would be to begin to take note. We have to learn about ourselves before we can change anything, develop new habits as it was placed. We need to take note of how we use the reins, how we use the horse as we now are. Yes, in the back.
So with that statement that you just made versus the statements of the stages that we go through from childhood, where is that coming from within us? I mean, where is that questioning coming from? The need for the questioning, for instance. Can that be related to then definitely reincarnation?
So the question is where the question is, where does the questioning come from? Well, the mind is our thinking principle, and we have that capacity to think and reason and to question and to choose and to feel and to remember and to compare and to be self-consciously aware of what we've done in the past and feel bad about it, or think about what we want to do in the future and plan because of the presence of mind in us. And that presence is due to the incarnation of the true spiritual being that we are, mind beings. We incarnate and make a connection with this human frame, with the principles of the passions and desires and our sensations. And that connection, in a way, becomes established more definitely at around the age of 7, and begins to develop at that point. And if you look at child development and as it progresses through those early years and into teenage years, we see more of the awareness of I, myself, what am I doing? And as we move into teenage years, there's that questioning, why do I have to do this? I want to do that. And beginning to wanting to exert one's own responsibility. And yet, even though you want responsibility and you want to do, you're still dependent on your parents. You don't have, and your parents and support. And so you're caught. And There's also the intensification of our passions around that time. So our developing minds, although questioning, haven't really freed themselves from those desires. And then as we grow older, hopefully we get some more maturity and begin to get some answers. We begin to search, begin to find meaning in families, and we begin to use our minds in more constructive ways. But it's the mind principle. It's the thinker, the knower. The knower who always wants to know more. You know some things, but there's no end to our learning. Wants to know more, that is questioning. And so we have to use that inherent divine gift, if we want to call it that, of questioning everything, but also questioning ourselves. Why do we think the way we do? Why do we act the way we do? What are our motives? And the more we do that, the more we see that for years we've been asleep, or we've been hypnotized, or self-hypnotized, or we've been imprisoned by all these ideas and feelings that other people told us, and we never really thought about it. But then as we begin to think about it, that's the key. That's where it can be in the question and say, well, I don't really want to do that anymore. And we begin to choose a higher path. Yes?
So we think perhaps that we need to develop the habit of introspection from the point of view of the observer, and the questioning, as was said, and that's a good habit to be in. It's the habit of not taking things at face value.
Uh-huh. At face value. And that, of course, is a human tendency to take things superficially on face value, because how do we gather our information usually? Through our senses. And our senses always see things, right, at face value, what appears to us. But as once we begin to use the mind, then we begin to question the impressions we get through our senses. But let's not kid ourselves. Questioning did not begin when we came to that awareness for the first time in our lives. People have been questioning for generations, for centuries, for ages, for millennia. And some minds have been questioning these ideas for lifetimes. And as they grow in their understanding, they bring that knowledge back. And we have the benefit. It is our inheritance, just as our parents pass on to us, or try to pass on to us, the principles which have helped them. So too, the human family has elder brothers, great souls, who periodically try to instruct it. So yes, we need to question, but we need to begin to search. And we need to begin to search for those sources that propose to put forth the answers to the questions that are most important to us. What am I? Who am I? Why am I here? How did I get here? What's my purpose here? Do I have responsibility? Is there hope for me? And why are we in this mess of a civilization? What should I do about it? Can I do anything about it? How do I get better? What path do I follow? And whenever we begin to do that as human beings, we begin to set on a journey. We begin to take a step of discovery. And as was pointed out, if our desire leans in that direction of getting those answers, then we gradually come in contact with those who know. And it may be in a religion or a philosophy or some book that begins to awaken us the idea that, yes, this is what I'm searching for. And all that is part of the theosophical movement, wherever thought has struggled to be free from its ignorance, from its superstition, from its prejudice, from its laziness. And sometimes in doing that, we have to tear down old institutions, political and religious and societal, that get in the way. Sometimes we have to work to improve the conditions of humanity around us that seem to obstruct us. And sometimes we need to, most importantly, work on ourselves. The obstacles in our own nature, the thoughts, the ideas, the misconceptions that we have in the light of those truths that we come in contact with. So it's a process, isn't it? You had a question before?
Yes.
You want to think about it? Or come
it's
on.
Not coming
up. Okay, yes.
Isn't that the symbolism of the Gita, that Arjuna, the enemy that he faces across from him, although its story is based on a real war, the symbolism of it is that these are attitudes and habits and beliefs that he has to destroy, that he has to go forth, and that's, he has a reluctance in his heart to do that, as we all do, to go against the things that we were raised with and been taught as sacred. They become idols to us, you know. We put them on pedestals and we never question them.
Mm-hmm. So those that are not, may not be familiar with the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, it's called the despondency of Arjuna. Every other of the 18 chapters begins with the word devotion to this means or that means, but the first is the despondency of Arjuna, and it represents that condition where the soul beginning to question and search for a better way, a higher way, who wants to live, finds out that the adversary is closer to home than they expected. And, of course, Arjuna, when he goes out to see the army that stands to oppose him, recognizes that he's going to have to fight and kill his old friends, his old teachers, his old companions who are arrayed against him. And he sinks down. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to be the murderers of my kin. I don't know what to do. I'm full of doubt. Tell me what I should do. I don't want to cause them pain and suffering. And yet, I have to in some ways. And so that conflict also, when we take it from a psychological point of view, leads us to the realization that we've built up many habits of thought and feeling and acting in the past, and they've become they were at one point our friends, our companions, our teachers, our guides. It's the way we lived. And now that we're beginning to question and search, we want to go in that direction, but these old habits are there, and we say, wait a second, you can't do that. I have a life of my own. I still want this. And so there's the struggle. And the first reaction very often is to want to give up, or it's too difficult, or find some easier way, or try to compromise, and it just doesn't work. And so that's the lesson of the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Yes?
Yesterday, we discussed about educating women to help change in the underdeveloped countries, to help change the course of those countries. But a lot of those countries are steeped in thousands of years of a certain mindset towards religion, towards the status of women. So when something is on that grand a scale, I mean, is there a way to change? I mean, we see what's happening when those minds are trying to be changed.
Yes.
Is there a way to do that?
Well, the contribution is that there are certain areas in the world where the traditions and therefore the political and social institutions are such that support those traditions seems to interfere with true education or the soul's learning and wanting to express itself free. And so that's why we say the theosophical movement is present wherever thought has struggled to be free. So in one way, we need to understand, well, what is it? What are the core ideas that are the foundation of those institutions, those nations, where there is that tyranny and the soul can't be free? What are the ideas there, and what ideas are going to eventually replace them? What efforts can be made? Some thoughts along that line.
Yeah, actually, that's precisely the
precisely what I was going to
okay.
And what we were coming up with is kind of a comparison. Buddha talks about this cycle of samsara, and those who follow his principles actually free their minds and free themselves from this necessary cycle, and they grow spiritually along that path. However, Western religions, Islam, and fundamental Christianity as well, teach different ideas, and we've read that the effect of those ideas actually forces people or puts minds in such a condition where not only in this life are they not more free, as in free to think, even, but it forces, it continues the cycle of reincarnation without lifting them out of it. And it has to do with the false ideas and the false understanding of who we are.
Mm-hmm. So
when we talk about, for instance, in the Middle East, and women need to be educated, everybody needs to be educated. There are fewer universities, fewer libraries, fewer book titles per capita in the Middle East than anywhere else in the and 40% of the people there are illiterate.
Yes. So Plato said, ideas rule the world. And unless we are free ourselves from erroneous or false ideas, they'll rule the world. Because those ideas that are false are held onto because of desire. They're self-serving. It's not the principle of truth that attracts us. It's the fact that those ideas play into and support our desire, our selfish desire. They are servants of the desire, rather than the desire being servants of the thoughts. In that case, the horse is running away with the chariot and the charioteer and crashing itself. So a theosophical education asks us to be questioning and searching for those universal truths, those ideas which stand the test of time, of experimentation, of consideration, of application, and prove themselves to be self-evident, rather than depending on some outside authority to tell us. And some of those fundamental ideas begin with our very concept of the source from which we come, how this universe operates. Is it operate under miracle, chance, law, divine intervention? Are we all from one supreme being, or do we all share in or an expression of that one eternal infinite source? How do we evolve? Do we evolve by chance? Are we animals? Are we the product of our genes? Or are we spiritual beings working through and guiding the evolution of a body? So all these are ideas out there, and we try to discern and discriminate which they are. In order to do that, we have to put aside our differences of opinion, because we all come from different cultures. We have to at least say, okay, let's form the nucleus of a universal brotherhood, at least where we're going to respect the differences of other human beings, put that aside, and at least say, okay, we're all thinkers, we're all spiritual beings, so establishing that, let's form our basis on that. Instead of saying, okay, we're all brothers and sisters because we believe in a certain religion or have a certain skin color or do a certain job, we're all going to get together on that universal principle that we're thinking spiritual beings. And then we're going to say, well, let's look at these different traditions. And instead of saying, oh, well, we just believe that and you're wrong, we're going to look at all of them and look at all of science and look at all philosophy. Instead of saying, no, philosophy's against religion and religion's against science, we're going to say, no, let's look at them and see what they're all saying that's the same, that it's true. And then instead of us saying, well, we're just animals or physical beings depending on the genes or chance or heredity or some supreme being, let's look at ourselves and see what kind of inner creative divine power we have. What proof do we have that we're spiritual beings? We accepted it in principle to get together. Now let's prove it for ourselves. And so those three objects, founding a nucleus of universal brotherhood, investigating sciences, religions, and philosophies, looking into the inner hidden occult side of our nature, has always been, down through the ages, the three objects of the theosophical movement. in some way. Because that's how we free ourselves. That's how we do it. Yes.
But the idea of women in any other part of the world and being treated in such a way, it's not isolated. It's not just there. It's here. It's everywhere in the world in which we live. And I mean, our respect for life, we need to question it. We think we are a very moral country and we care, but our consciousness is embedded, or our mindset is embedded in making money,
mm-hmm.
exploiting the earth to make some rich and many poor.
Mm-hmm.
So that mindset is probably the creation of more suffering in the world than what is being mentioned. So,
yes.
You know, it's you know, and we're directly involved in this, whether we like it or not.
Yes. Well, we certainly can speak of the plight of women down through the ages, but we could just as easily speak of the plight of all human beings who are discriminated against and limited because of their sex, condition, race, creed, organization, color, nationality, whatever. It all comes down to the same idea of an idea of separateness. And it is this idea of separateness which really, we might say, feeds into our desires. Because as long as we believe that we are separate, that we are different based on our external appearances, we're justified in pursuing whatever is good for us without concern about the other. And actually, what's life all about? What's about what I do? It's the toys I have. It's the power I have. And the more we think that we can act that way and not be responsible, that it will have no effect, that we'll get away with it, well, then the more we're going to do that. So there are certain ideas that enslave us, but not just enslave us, they mislead us. You know, you have, enslavery doesn't mean you're put in a prison. It means you're subjugated to perform a task for the taskmaster. So when the mind is enslaved, it's not just limited by desire, it's directed by desires to do what the desires want, what our passions want. Yes.
It's interesting. Here we are in Philadelphia, and the subject this morning reminds me of such words as the Declaration of Independence and freedom. Could you, is there any connection between those particular ideas that we find in the Declaration of Independence, and how did they get there? How is it that in the United States, here in America, those ideas are written down and you're supposed to be governed by them?
Well, we say that the Declaration of Independence, we find these truths to be self-evident, that all beings, human beings are created, are endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, those rights being of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, life, well, we can agree with that, right? We're all entitled to live. Liberty, we all want liberty. Now, the kicker is the pursuit of happiness. What does that mean? Because if we all have the right to pursue happiness, does that give us license to do whatever we want, whatever we desire? Well, if we believe that, then we're in trouble, because then government has to step in, whether it's a tyrant or a beneficent dictator or an authoritarian government or a legislative body or a president or a king, and tell us, no, you can't do that. The society will fall apart. So, yes, we are endowed with the right to pursuit of happiness, meaning the highest pleasure of the soul, a spiritual being. And what is the highest pleasure and need of the soul? The highest pleasure of need of the soul. And we know it through our own experience. When do we feel most content? When we have loved somebody and been loved, when we have helped somebody and been helped in a real way, in a lasting way, when we've lifted them up, when we've been lifted up, and when we've learned something new that we didn't know before that helps us love and do things better for others, or when somebody teaches us. So that is the real happiness. That is our right. And any external government that would interfere with that has to be done away with. And that's the declaration. We also want to mention that we say today is St. Patrick's Day, or we're celebrating St. Patrick. Well, who was St. Patrick? Anybody know who St. Patrick was?
That's why I'm wearing orange. he drove the snakes out of Ireland, and the snakes represent the wise ones, the adepts.
Okay. Now, does anyone really think that somebody would be called a saint if they drove snakes, those little crawly things on the ground, out of Ireland? No, the snakes were symbols there of wise human beings. And the snake or the serpent has always been a symbol of the wise ones. Be wise as serpents, as harmless as doves. Jesus said that. So the serpents that St. Patrick drove out of Ireland were the Druids in those areas, who were the containers, the part of the theosophical movement in those ancient islands that kept these ideas alive among the people. They had other practices which we have remnants of them today in our celebrations, such as the mistletoe and other things during Christmas. But they were very active there. And at one point, you had the Christian church, which at that time was Rome, and the church were the same, coming into that area and having to crush and literally massacre the Druid centers and the Druids. And the whole King Arthur, the real story of King Arthur, not the legend that evolved in the Middle Ages and in the 13th and 14th century, but the real story there has to do, and Merlin himself was a Druid, represents that Druidic knowledge. The whole struggle at one point for among the people to deal with this encroaching power of Christianity. And Christianity in those times was not the Christianity we know today. The monks, the priests there, bought their way in through power. They subjugated people by torture. They were not the well-intentioned priests and monks that we see today, and yet they had a very strong influence. So what else does that mean, the crushing of the serpent? Well, in another way, the serpent in our nature is our psychic nature, our feeling, and very much our passionate nature. And one of the devotional books tells us in that psychic part of our nature, behind each flower, there's a serpent coiled. And we have to recognize it and crush it out. And that serpent that we mostly know is that principle of desire. Yes, it's beautiful. It's like a flower. Who doesn't like wonderful desires stimulated by beautiful music and beautiful pictures and beautiful smells? Who doesn't like it? But we also know under every one of those desires, there's a serpent in the negative sense, the possibility for abuse and misuse of that. And that has to be crushed out. So that's, we might say, the real lesson or value, if we might say, of St. Patrick Day. If we're going to be a warrior priest, what we need to sacrifice in ourselves is those negative tendencies, that which enslaves us. Yes?
You just said that St. Patrick drove the serpents out of Ireland, and then you said under flower, a serpent coral,
yes.
That is, we need to then in the Garden of Eden, when the serpent tempted Adam and Eve, how do we distinguish what's the symbol that we're being presented with? Because sometimes we're confused. We think it could be a higher expression, but it's really not. It's really something really mundane.
Well, the serpent certainly has gotten a bad rap from the Garden of Eden. And we still fear serpents today. Nobody trusts a serpent or a snake. It's sort of built into our consciousness. Where did that come from? Why that prejudice? Yes?
Excuse me, I would like to disagree with you. It's the female that got the bad rap. The snake is just considered to be tricky, but the woman was wrong.
Of course, yes, and she was in courts with the serpent. Yes, they both got the bad rap, at least in that sense. Well, at least Adam blamed his wife, and they both blamed the serpent. Okay. So, the serpent there in that story is what? It's, we have Adam and Eve running around, having a good time, very passive, enjoying themselves, not really doing anything except eating, having the good life, not really making anything of their lives, not evolving. And this serpent comes along and says, well, look, I can give you the gift of knowledge and good and evil. It's going to be a great thing for you. But it also turned out to be a curse, because they were cursed, not by the serpent, but by God. And they were cursed. Now they had to go out, and Eve had to bear children in pain, and they had to till the soil. They had to go out in the Garden of Eden, and so forth. So the acquirement of knowledge, particularly the acquired of mind, self-consciousness, awareness, free choice, is a double-edged sword, just like the serpent is double-edged. It gives us free choice and the ability to advance and improve our evolution that much quicker. We don't have to just be guided by natural impulse. We can make choices, we can do things. It also is a curse in the sense that we can choose not to do it. We can create problems for ourselves. We become more self-consciously aware of our suffering, of our difficulties. We become more guilty of when we've done the wrong thing. And the first thing Adam says is, I hid because after eating I realized I had done something wrong. You know, so this whole story is symbolic, is an allegory about the consequences of us acquiring mind. And yes, we need to free it from that which drags it down, which tends to be the curse of that incarnation, so we can live as real spiritual beings, as mind beings, even while we are in the world. Yes?
And then there is the serpent is definitely an ambiguous symbol, isn't it?
Yes.
But for the theosophist, the serpent is part of the symbol of the theosophical society. It is the uropos, the serpent that bites it.
Because the serpent has always been a symbol of eternity. The serpent swallowing its tail, the serpent sloughing off its skin and growing a new one, the cycle of regeneration, reproduction, of never-ending development of cycles. So it is a good emblem. It's also the symbol of wisdom, not only in the ancient Americas, but in the East as well, and also in Ireland. The Celts called the Druids, they were called serpents and snakes.
Pardon? Because they were wise.
Because they were wise, yes. They were given that name. And as we said, Jesus says, be ye wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Yes.
We think one of the problems, though, in our world today is know and that our way is the right way for everybody else. So it's an imposition on others' minds instead of what you talked about, a meeting of minds. So yes, we see cultures where individuals are definitely suppressed and mistreated. But we have to realize at the same time that is a karma that maybe nobody can change at this moment. We should put forth the best effort we can not to make them like us, but to make them free to make their own choices.
Yes. Now, even within those cultures where there is apparent domination and subjugation, the theosophical movement in some degree is still present in small groups, perhaps in secrecy, in quiet, underground, because obviously to expose themselves would subject them to the same persecution. And there are many examples of that in modern history and certainly today. So there are and even during the Middle Ages in Europe, when there was ignorance and persecution in a different way, many of the aspects of the theosophical movement in the different groups active were underground, and they communicated with each other most. When they didn't meet in secret, they communicated with one another in symbols, which only they could understand. And some of the great men and women who are society honors today in secret studied and were influenced by many of these ideas. It was the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution in the United States, and also in some ways the French Revolution in Europe, which created the conditions where there could be freedom again of thought in the West to begin to pursue those ideas. Because up until then, you had the authoritative will of the church, or you had the authoritative rule of a king or a regency in that way. And that those two revolutions, in that sense, broke down independently of each other, those authorities. Yes?
That point speaks to there must be enough dissatisfaction for there to be a major change like that, like Plymouth Rock, like what was just described, for enough people to rise up. There has to be a shared dissatisfaction enough that they're willing to sacrifice whatever might be necessary to change. But we think that's why it takes so long and is so difficult.
Well, we would have thought that too, and that we saw the Soviet Empire and the Berlin Wall literally crumble overnight. Now, there are still difficulties there, but there have been revolutions in modern times that seem to happen pretty quickly. Yeah. So, and even in our own countries, in our own country, there have been dramatic changes that have occurred within a generation where that would not have occurred in the past. So, yeah. Remember we talked about the teenager that begins to rebel, becomes dissatisfied with the parents, the authorities, and begins to question. Well, in a sense, we're all teenagers in that when we become dissatisfied and want to pursue our ideas and are beginning to question and want to challenge the existing authorities. In that sense, as adults, we take the example of the inquiring youth. And now with the benefit of our wisdom, we try to do it in a better constructive way if we can. But if we can't, then we try to use other peaceful means. And there are other ways of doing it besides war and conflict, as Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King have demonstrated. So we need to stop here, but once again, we invite you to come this week. Wednesday for our special meeting, William Kwan Judge Day, and also next Sunday, where we pick up again this idea of the mysteries of mind with the subject, the power and nature of soul memory. Our meeting's adjourned.